If you're Dick, prove it. Tell me something only he and I could know. Silence. But the presence was still here. He felt it. Then.
You asked me why Mrs. Brandt wanted the car park man's pants.
Dan at first had no idea what the voice was talking about. Then he did. The memory was on one of the high shelves where he kept all the bad overlooked memories, and his lockboxes, of course. Mrs. Brandt had been a checkout on the day Danny arrived with his parents, and he had caught a random thought from her as the overlook's valet delivered her car.
I'd sure like to get into his pants.
You were just a little boy with a great big radio inside your head. I felt sorry for you. I was scared for you, too.
And I was right to be scared, wasn't I? In that, there was a faint echo of his old friend's kindness and humor. It was Dick, all right. Dan looked at the dead woman, dumbfounded. The lights in the room flickered on and off again. The water pitcher gave another brief jitter.
I can't stay long, son. It hurts to be here.
Dick, there's a little girl.
Abra. Almost a sigh. She's like you. It all comes around.
She thinks there's a woman who may be after her. She wears a hat. It's an old-fashioned top hat. Sometimes she only has one long tooth on top. When she's hungry. This is what she told me, anyway.
Ask your question, son. I can't stay. This world is a dream of a dream to me now.
There are others, the top hat woman's friends. Abra saw them with flashlights. Who are they? Silence again. But Dick was still there. Changed, but there. Dan could feel him in his nerve endings and as a kind of electricity skating on the damp surfaces of his eyes.
They are the empty devils. They are sick and don't know it.
I don't understand.
No, and that's good. If you had ever met them, if they had ever gotten so much as a sniff of you, you'd be long dead, used and thrown away like an empty carton. That's what happened to the one Abra calls the baseball boy, and many others. Children who shine are prey to them. But you already guessed that, didn't you? The empty devils are on the land like a cancer on the skin. Once they rode camels in the desert. Once they drove caravans across Eastern Europe. They eat screams and drink pain. You had your horrors at the Overlook, Danny, but at least you were spared these folks. Now that the strange woman has her mind fixed on the girl, they won't stop until they have her. They might kill her. They might turn her. Or they might keep her and use her until she's all used up, and that would be worst of all. I don't understand. Scoop her out. Make her empty like them. From the dead mouth there came an autumnal sigh. Dick, what the hell am I supposed to do? Get the girl what she asked for. Where are they, these empty devils? In your childhood. Where every devil comes from. I'm not allowed to say more. How do I stop them? The only way is to kill them. Make them eat their own poison. Do that and they disappear. The woman in the hat, the strange woman, what's her name? Do you know? From down the hall came the clash of a mop bucket squeegee and Paul Larson began to whistle. The air in the room changed. Something that had been delicately balanced now began to swing out of true. Go to your friends, the ones who know what you are. It seems to me you grew up fine, son, but you still owe a debt.
There was a pause, and then the voice that both was and wasn't Dick Halloran's spoke one final time in a tone of flat command.
Pay it.
Red mist rose from Eleanor's eyes, nose, and open mouth. It hung over her for perhaps 5 seconds, then disappeared. The lights were steady. So was the water in the pitcher. Dick was gone. Dan was here with only a corpse.
Empty devils.
If he had ever heard a more terrible phrase, he couldn't remember it. But it made sense if you had seen the Overlook for what it really was. That place had been full of devils, but at least they had been dead devils. He didn't think that was true of the woman in the top hat and her friends.
You still owe a debt.
Pay it.
Yes. He had left the little boy in the sagging diaper and the Braves t-shirt to fend for himself. He would not do that with the girl.
4. Dan waited at the nurse's station for the funeral hack from Geordie and Sons and saw the covered gurney out the back door of Rivington 1. Then he went to his room and sat looking down at Cranmore Avenue, now perfectly deserted. A night wind blew, stripping the early turning leaves from the oaks and sending them dancing and pirouetting up the street. On the far side of the town common, Teeny Town was equally deserted beneath a couple of orange high-intensity security lights.
Go to your friends, the ones who know what you are.
Billy Freeman knew. Had almost from the first, because Billy had some of what Dan had. And if Dan owed a debt, he supposed Billy did too, because Dan's larger and brighter shining had saved Billy's life. Not that I'd put it that way to him. Not that he'd have to. Then there was John Dalton, who had lost a watch and who just happened to be Abra's pediatrician. What had Dick said through Eleanor Ooh-La-La's dead mouth? It all comes around. As for the thing Abra had asked for, that was even easier. Getting it, though, that might be a little complicated.
5.
When Abra got up on Sunday morning, there was an email message from dtor36@nhml.com.
Abra, I have spoken to a friend using the talent we share and am convinced that you are in danger. I want to speak about your situation to another friend, one we have in common, John Dalton. I will not do so unless I have your permission. I believe John and I can retrieve the object you drew on my blackboard. Have you set your burglar alarm? Certain people may be looking for you, and it's very important they not find you. You must be careful. Good wishes and stay safe. Delete this email. Uncle D.
She was more convinced by the fact of his email than its content, because she knew he didn't like communicating that way. He was afraid her parents would snoop in her mail and think she was exchanging notes with Chester the molester. If they only knew about the molester she really had to worry about. She was frightened, but also, now that it was bright daylight and there was no beautiful lunatic in a top hat peering in the window at her, rather excited. It was sort of like being in one of those love and horror supernatural novels, the kind Mrs. Robinson in the school library sniffily called tweenager porn. In those books, the girls dallied with werewolves, vampires, even zombies, but hardly ever became those things. It was also nice to have a grown man stand up for her, and it didn't hurt that he was handsome. In a scruffy kind of way that reminded her a little of Jax Teller on Sons of Anarchy, a show she and Emma Dean secretly watched on Em's computer. She sent Uncle Dan's email not just to her trash, but to the permanent trash, which Emma called the nuclear boyfriend file. As if you had any, Em, Abra thought snidely. Then she turned off her computer and closed the lid. She didn't email him back. She didn't have to. She just had to close her eyes. Zip, zip. Message sent. Abra headed for the shower.
6. When Dan came back with his morning coffee, there was a new communique on his blackboard. You can tell Dr. John, but not my parents.
No, not her parents. At least not yet. But Dan had no doubt they'd find out something was going on, and probably sooner rather than later. He would cross that bridge, or burn it, when he came to it. Right now he had a lot of other things to do, beginning with a call. A child answered, and when he asked for Rebecca, the phone was dropped with a clunk, and there was a distant, going-away cry of, "Grandma, it's for you!" A few seconds later, Rebecca Clausen was on the line. "Hi, Becca, it's Dan Torrance."
"It's about Mrs. Willett. I had an email this morning from..."
"That's not it. I need to ask for some time off."
"Dr. Sleep wants time off? I don't believe it. I had to practically kick you out the door last spring to take your vacation, and you were still in once or twice a day. Is it a family matter?"
Dan, with Abra's theory of relativity in mind, said it was. Chapter 10. Glass Ornaments. 1. Abra's father was standing at the kitchen counter in his bathrobe and beating eggs in a bowl when the kitchen phone rang. Upstairs, the shower was pounding. If Abra followed her usual Sunday morning M.O., it would continue to pound until the hot water gave out. He checked the incoming call window. It was a 617 area code, but the number following wasn't the one in Boston he knew, the one that rang the landline in his grandmother-in-law's condo. "Hello?"
"Oh, David, I'm so glad I got you."
It was Lucy, and she sounded utterly exhausted.
"Where are you? Why aren't you calling from your cell?"
"Mass General, on a payphone. You can't use cells in here. There are signs everywhere."
"Is Momo all right? Are you?"
"I am. As for Moms, she's stable.
Now."
"But for a while it was pretty bad."
A gulp.
"It still is."
That was when Lucy broke down. Not just crying, but sobbing her heart out. David waited. He was glad Abra was in the shower and hoped the hot water would hold out for a long time. This sounded bad. At last, Lucy was able to talk again.
"This time, she broke her arm."
"Oh, okay. Is that all?"
"No, it is not all."
Nearly shouting at him in that "why are men so stupid" voice that he absolutely loathed, the one he told himself was a part of her Italian heritage, without ever considering that he might, on occasion, actually be quite stupid. He took a steadying breath. "Tell me, honey." She did, although twice she broke into sobs again and David had to wait her out. She was dead beat, but that was only part of the problem. Mostly, he realized, she was just accepting in her gut what her head had known for weeks. Her Momo was really going to die. Maybe not peacefully. Conchetta, who slept in only the thinnest of dozes now, had awakened after midnight and needed the toilet. Instead of buzzing for Lucy to bring the bedpan, she had tried to get up and go to the bathroom by herself. She had managed to swing her legs out onto the floor and sit up, but then dizziness had overcome her and she had tumbled off the bed, landing on her left arm. It hadn't just broken, it had shattered. Lucy, tired out from weeks of night nursing that she had never been trained to do, awoke to the sound of her grandmother's cries.
"She wasn't just calling for help," Lucy said, "and she wasn't screaming either. She was shrieking, like a fox that's had a limb torn off in one of those terrible leg-hold traps."
"Honey, that must have been awful."
Standing in a first-floor alcove where there were snack machines and mirabile dictu, a few working phones, her body aching and covered with drying sweat, she could smell herself, and it sure wasn't Dolce and Gabbana light blue, her head pounding with the first migraine she'd had in 4 years. Lucia Stone knew she could never tell him how awful it had really been. What a stinking revelation it had been.
"You thought you understood the basic fact. Woman grows old, woman grows feeble, woman dies. And then you discovered there was quite a lot more to it. You found that out when you found the woman who had written some of the greatest poetry of her generation lying in a puddle of her own piss.
shrieking at her granddaughter to make the pain stop. Make it stop. Oh, Madre de Cristo, make it stop. When you saw the formerly smooth forearm twisted like a wash rag and heard the poet call it a cunting thing and then wish yourself dead so the hurting would stop. Could you tell your husband how you were still half asleep and frozen with the fear that anything you did would be the wrong thing? Could you tell him that she scratched your face when you tried to move her and howled like a dog that had been run over in the street? Could you explain what it was like to leave your beloved grandmother sprawled on the floor while you dialed 911 and then sat beside her waiting for the ambulance, making her drink oxycodone dissolved in water through a bindi straw? How the ambulance didn't come and didn't come, and you thought of that Gordon Lightfoot song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, the one that asks if anyone knows where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours. The waves rolling over Momo were waves of pain, and she was foundering, and they just kept coming. When she began to scream again, Lucy had gotten both arms under her and lifted her onto her bed in a clumsy, clean and jerk that she knew she'd feel in her shoulders and lower back for days, if not weeks. Stopping her ears to Momo's cries of, "Put me down! You're killing me!" Then Lucy sat against the wall gasping, her hair plastered to her cheeks in strings while Momo wept and cradled her hideously deformed arm and asked why Lucia would hurt her like that and why this was happening to her. At last the ambulance had come, and a man, Lucy didn't know his name, but blessed him in her incoherent prayers, had given Momo a shot that put her out. Could you tell your husband you wished the shot had killed her? "It was pretty awful," was all she said. "I'm so glad Abra didn't want to come down this weekend."
"She did, but she had lots of homework and said she had to go to the library yesterday. It must have been a big deal, because you know how she usually pesters me about going to the football game."
Babbling. Stupid. But what else was there?
"Luce, I'm so goddamn sorry you had to go through that alone."
"It's just, if you could have heard her screaming, then you might understand. I never want to hear anyone scream like that again. She's always been so great at staying calm, keeping her head when all about her are losing theirs."
"I know."
"And then to be reduced to what she was last night.
The only words she could remember were cunt and shit and piss and fuck and meretrice and..."
"Let it go, honey."
Upstairs the shower had quit. It would only take Abra a few minutes to dry off and jump into her Sunday grubs. She'd be down soon enough, shirt tail flying and sneaker laces flapping. But Lucy wasn't quite ready to let it go.
"I remember a poem she wrote once. I can't quote it word for word, but it started something like this. God's a connoisseur of fragile things and decorates his cloudy outlook with ornaments of finest glass. I used to think that was a rather conventionally pretty idea for a Concetta Reynolds poem, almost twee."
And here was his Abadou. There, Abadou, with her skin flushed from the shower.
"Everything all right, Daddy?"
David held up a hand. "Wait a minute."
"Now I know what she really meant, and I'll never be able to read that poem again."
"Abby's here, hon," he said in a falsely jolly voice.
"Good. I'll need to talk to her. I'm not going to bawl anymore, so don't worry. But we can't protect her from this."
"Maybe from the worst of it?" he asked gently. Abra was standing by the table, her wet hair pulled into a couple of horsetails that made her look 10 again. Her expression was grave.
"Maybe," she agreed. "But I can't do this anymore, Davy. Not even with day help. I thought I could, but I can't. There's a hospice in Fraser, just a little way down the road. The intake nurse told me about it. I think hospitals must keep a list for just this type of situation. Anyway, the place is called Helen Rivington House. I called them before I called you, and they have a vacancy as of today. I guess God pushed another of his ornaments off the mantelpiece last night."
"Is Chetta awake? Have you discussed this?"
"She came around a couple of hours ago, but she was muddy. Had the past and present all mixed together in a kind of salad."
"While I was still fast asleep,"
David thought guiltily. Dreaming about my book, no doubt. When she clears up, I'm assuming she will, I'll tell her, as gently as I can, that the decision isn't hers to make. It's time for hospice care.
All right. When Lucy decided something, really decided, the best thing was to stand clear and let her work her will.
Dad? Is Mom okay? Is Momo?
Abra knew her mother was and her great-grandmother wasn't. Most of what Lucy had told her husband had come to her while she was still in the shower, standing there with shampoo and tears running down her cheeks. But she had gotten good at putting on happy faces until someone told her out loud that it was time to put on a sad one. She wondered if her new friend Dan had learned about the happy face thing as a kid. She bet he had.
Chia, I think Abby wants to talk to you.
Lucy sighed and said,
"Put her on."
David held out the phone to his daughter.
2. At 2 p.m. on that Sunday, Rose the Hat hung a sign reading, "Do not disturb me unless absolutely necessary," on the door of her plus-size RV. The coming hours had been carefully scheduled. She would eat no food today and drink only water. Instead of mid-morning coffee, she had taken an emetic. When the time came to go after the girl's mind, she would be as clear as an empty glass. With no bodily functions to distract her, Rose would be able to find out everything she needed. The girl's name, her exact location, how much she knew, and, this was very important, who she might have talked to. Rose would lie still on her double bed in the Earth Cruiser from 4 in the afternoon until 10 in the evening, looking up at the ceiling and meditating. When her mind was as clear as her body, she would take steam from one of the canisters in the hidden compartment. Just a whiff would be enough, and once again turn the world until she was in the girl. And the girl was in her. At 1 in the morning Eastern time, her quarry would be dead asleep, and Rose could pick through the contents of her mind at will. It might even be possible to plant a suggestion. Some men will come. They will help you. Go with them. But as that old school farmer poet Bobby Burns pointed out more than 200 years before, the best laid plans of mice and men gang aft agley, and she had barely begun to recite the beginning phrases of her relaxation mantra when an agley came hammering at her door.
"Go away," she shouted. "Can't you read the sign?"
"Rose, I've got Nut with me," Crow called. "I think he's got what you asked for. But he needs a go-ahead, and the timing on this thing is a bitch."
She lay there for a moment, then blew out an angry breath and got up, snatching the Sidewinder T-shirt, "Kiss Me at the Roof of the World," and pulling it over her head. It dropped to the tops of her thighs. She opened the door. This better be good.
"We can come back," Walnut said.
He was a little man with a bald pate and brillo pads of gray hair fluffing out above the tops of his ears. He held a sheet of paper in one hand.
"No, just make it quick."
They sat at the table in the combined kitchen living room. Rose snatched the paper from Nut's hand and gave it a cursory glance. It was some sort of complicated chemical diagram filled with hexagons. It meant nothing to her. "What is it?"
"A powerful sedative," Nut said. "It's new, and it's clean. Jimmy got this chem sheet from one of our assets in the NSA. It'll put her out with no chance of ODing her."
"It could be what we need, all right." Rose knew she sounded grudging. "But couldn't it have waited until tomorrow?"
Sorry, Nut said meekly.
"I'm not," Crow said. "If you want to move fast on this girl and snatch her clean, I'll not only have to make sure we can get some of this, I'll have to arrange for it to be shipped to one of our mail drops."
The True had hundreds of these across America, most of them at mailboxes, etc., and various UPS stores. Using them meant planning days ahead because they always traveled in their RVs. Members of the True would no more get on public transportation than they would slit their own throats. Private air travel was possible, but unpleasant. They suffered extreme altitude sickness. Walnut believed it had something to do with their nervous systems, which differed radically from those of the Rubes. Rose's concern was with a certain taxpayer-funded nervous system. Very nervous. Homeland Security had been monitoring even private flights very closely since 9/11, and the True Nuts' first rule of survival was never attract attention. Thanks to the interstate highway system, the RVs had always served their purposes and would this time. A small raiding party, with new drivers taking the wheel every 6 hours, could get from Sidewinder to northern New England in less than 30 hours. "All right," she said, mollified. "What have we got along I-90 in upstate New York or Massachusetts?"
Crow didn't hem and haw or tell her he'd have to get back to her on that. "Easy Mail Services in Sturbridge, Massachusetts."
She flapped her fingers at the edge of the sheet of incomprehensible chemistry Nut was holding in his hand. "Have this stuff sent there. Use at least 3 cutouts so we have complete deniability if something goes wrong. Really bounce it around."
"Do we have that much time?" Crow asked.
"I don't see why not," Rose said, a remark that would come back to haunt her. "Send it south, then into the Midwest, then into New England. Just get it to Sturbridge by Thursday. Use express mail, not FedEx or UPS.
"I can do that," Crow said, no hesitation.
Rose turned her attention to the True's doctor. "You better be right, Walnut. If you do OD her instead of just putting her to sleep, I'll see you're the first True to be sent into exile since Little Bighorn."
Walnut paled a little.
"Good. She had no intention of exiling anyone, but she still resented being interrupted."
"We'll get the drug to Sturbridge, and Nut will know how to use it," Crow said. "No problem."
"There's nothing simpler. Something we can get around here,"
Nut said. "Not if you want to be sure she doesn't go Michael Jackson on us. This stuff is safe, and it hits fast. If she's as powerful as you seem to think, fast is going to be important."
"Okay, okay, I get it. Are we done here?"
"There's one more thing," Walnut said. "I suppose it could wait, but..."
She looked out the window, and ye gods and little fishes, here came Jimmy Numbers, bustling across the parking lot adjacent to the Overlook Lodge with his own sheet of paper. Why had she hung the Do Not Disturb sign on her doorknob? Why not one that said, "Y'all come"? Rose gathered all her bad temper, stuffed it in a sack, stored it at the back of her mind, and smiled gamely. "What is it?"
"Grandpa Flick," Crow said, "is no longer holding his fudge."
"He hasn't been able to hold it for the last 20 years, Rose said. "He won't wear diapers, and I can't make him. No one can make him."
"This is different," Nut said. "They can barely get out of bed. Baba and Black-Eyed Susie are taking care of him as well as they can, but that camper of his smells like the wrath of God."
"He'll get better. We'll feed him some steam." But she didn't like the look on Nut's face. Tommy the truck had passed 2 years ago, and by the way the True measured time, that might have been 2 weeks ago. Now Grandpa Flick...
"His mind's breaking down," Crow said bluntly. "And..." He looked at Walnut. "Petty was taking care of him this morning, and she says she thinks she saw him cycle."
"Thinks," Rose said. She didn't want to believe it. "Has anyone else seen it happen? Baba? Sue?"
"No."
She shrugged as if to say, "There you are." Jimmy knocked before they could discuss it farther, and this time she was glad for the interruption.
"Come in!" Jimmy poked his head through.
"Sure, it's okay."
"Yes, why don't you bring the Rockettes and the UCLA marching band while you're at it?"
Hell, I was only trying to get in a meditation groove after a few pleasant hours of spewing my guts.
Crow was giving her a look of mild reproof, and maybe she deserved it. Probably she deserved it. These people were only doing the True's work as she had asked them to do it. But if Crow ever stepped up to the captain's chair, he'd understand. Never a moment to yourself unless you threatened them with pain of death. And in many cases, not even then.
"I got something you may want to see," Jimmy said. "And since Crow and Nut were already here, I figured..."
"I know what you figured. What is it?"
"I went hunting around on the internet for news about those two towns you zeroed in on, Freiburg and Anniston. Found this in the Union Leader. It's from last Thursday's paper. Maybe it's nothing."
She took the sheet. The main item was about some podunk school shutting down their football program because of budget cuts. Beneath it was a shorter item which Jimmy had circled.
Pocket earthquake reported in Anniston. How small can an earthquake be? Pretty small if the people of Richland Court, a short Anniston street that dead ends at the Saco River, are to be believed. Late Tuesday afternoon, several residents of the street reported a tremor that rattled windows, shook floors, and sent glassware tumbling from shelves. Dane Borland, a retiree who lives at the end of the street, pointed out a crack running the width of his newly asphalted driveway. "If you want proof, there it is," he said. Although the Geological Survey Center in Wrentham, Massachusetts, reports there were no timblers in New England last Tuesday afternoon, Matt and Cassie Renfrew took the opportunity to throw an earthquake party, which most of the street's residents attended. Andrew Sittenfeld of the Geological Survey Center says the shaking felt by Richland Court residents might have been a surge of water through the sewer system, or possibly a military plane breaking the sound barrier. When these suggestions were made to Mr. Renfrew, he laughed cheerfully. "We know what we felt," he said. "It was an earthquake, and there's really no downside. The damage was minor, and hey, we got a terrific party out of it." Andrew Gould.
Rose read it twice, then looked up, eyes bright. "Good catch, Jimmy." He grinned.
"Thanks. I'll leave you guys to it, then."
"Take Nut with you. He needs to check on Grandpa. Crow, you stay a minute."
When they were gone, he closed the door. "You think the girl caused that shake in New Hampshire?"
"I do. Not 100% certain, but at least 80. And having a place to focus on, not just a town, but a street, will make things a hell of a lot easier for me tonight when I go looking for her."
"If you can stick a come-along worm in her head, Rosie, we may not even need to knock her out."
She smiled, thinking again that Crow had no idea how special this one was. Later she would think, "Neither did I. I only thought I did."
"There's no law against hoping, I suppose. But once we have her, we'll need something a little more sophisticated than a Mickey Finn, even if it's a high-tech one. We'll need some wonder drug that'll keep her nice and cooperative until she decides it's in her best interest to cooperate on her own."
"Will you be coming with us when we go to grab her?"
Rose had assumed so, but now she hesitated, thinking of Grandpa Flick. "I'm not sure."
He didn't ask questions, which she appreciated, and turned to the door. "I'll see that you're not disturbed again."
"Good. And you make sure Walnut gives Grandpa a complete exam. I mean, from asshole to appetite. If he really is cycling, I want to know tomorrow when I come out of Perda."
She opened the compartment under the floor and brought out one of the canisters.
"And give him what's left in this."
Crow was shocked. "All of it. Rose, if he's cycling, there's no point."
"Give it to him. We've had a good year, as several of you have pointed out to me lately. We can afford a little extravagance. Besides, the True Knot only has one grandpa. He remembers when the people of Europe worshipped trees instead of timeshare condos. We're not going to lose him if we can help it. We're not savages.
The rubes might beg to differ.
That's why they're rubes. Now get out of here.
3. After Labor Day, Teeny Town closed at 3 p.m. on Sundays. This afternoon at 5:45, three giants sat on benches near the end of the mini Cranmore Avenue, dwarfing Teeny Town Drug and the Teeny Town Music Box Theater, where during tourist season you could peek in the window and see teeny film clips playing on a teeny screen. John Dalton had come to the meeting wearing a Red Sox hat, which he placed on the head of the teeny Helen Rivington statue in the teeny courthouse square. "I'm sure she was a fan," he said. "Everybody up this way is a fan. Nobody spares a little admiration for the Yankees except exiles like me. What can I do for you, Dan? I'm missing supper with the family for this. My wife's an understanding woman, but her patience only stretches so far."
"How would she feel about you spending a few days with me in Iowa?" Dan asked. "Strictly on my dime, you understand. I have to make a 12th-step call on an uncle who's killing himself with booze and cocaine. My family's begging me to step in, and I can't do it alone." AA had no rules, but many traditions that were, in fact, rules. One of the most ironclad was that you never made a 12th-step call on an active alcoholic by yourself, unless the alky in question was safely incarcerated in a hospital, detox, or the local bug house. If you did, you were apt to end up matching him drink for drink and line for line. Addiction, Casey Kingsley liked to say, was the gift that kept on giving. Dan looked at Billy Freeman and smiled. "Got something to say? Go ahead, feel free."
"I don't think you got an uncle. I'm not sure you've got any family left at all."
"Is that it? You're just not sure?"
"Well, you never talk about them."
"Plenty of people have family and don't talk about them. But you know I don't have anyone, don't you, Billy?" Billy said nothing but looked uneasy.
"Denny, I can't go to Iowa," John said. "I'm booked right into the weekend."
Dan was still focused on Billy. Now he reached into his pocket, grabbed something, and held out his closed fist. "What have I got?" Billy looked more uneasy than ever. He glanced at John, saw no help there, then back to Dan. "John knows what I am," Dan said. "I helped him once, and he knows I've helped a few others in the program. You're among friends here." Billy thought about it, then said,
"It might be a coin, but I think it's one of your AA medals. The kind they give you every time you're getting another year sober."
"What year's this one?" Billy hesitated, looking at Dan's fisted hand.
"Let me help you out," John said. "He's been sober since the spring of 2001, so if he's carrying a medallion around, it's probably a year 12.
"Makes sense, but it ain't." Billy was concentrating now, two deep vertical lines grooving his forehead just about his eyes.
"I think you might be a 7?
Dan opened his palm. The medallion had a big Roman numeral 6 on it.
"Fuckaroo," Billy said. "I'm usually good at guessing."
"You were close enough," Dan said. "And it's not guessing. It's shining." Billy took out his cigarettes, looked at the doctor sitting on the bench next to him, and put them back.
"If you say so."
"Let me tell you a little about yourself, Billy. When you were small, you were great at guessing things. You knew when your mother was in a good mood and you could hit her for an extra buck or two. You knew when your dad was in a bad one and you steered clear of him."
"I sure knew there were nights when bitching about having to eat leftover pot roast would be a goddamn bad idea," Billy said.
"Did you gamble?"
"Horse races down Salem. Made a bundle. Then, when I was 25 or so, I kind of lost the knack of picking winners. I had a month when I had to beg an extension on the rent, and that cured me of railbedding."
"Yes, the talent fades as people grow older, but you still have some."
"You got more," Billy said,
no hesitation now. "This is real, isn't it?" John said. It really wasn't a question, it was an observation. You've only got one appointment this coming week you really feel you can't miss or hand off, Dan said. It's a little girl with stomach cancer. Her name is Felicity. Frederica, John said. Frederica Bimmel. She's at Merrimack Valley Hospital. I'm supposed to have a consult with her oncologist and her parents. Saturday morning. Yeah. Saturday morning. He gave Dan an amazed look. Jesus. Jesus Christ. What you have. I had no idea there was so much of it. I'll have you back from Iowa by Thursday. Friday at the latest. Unless we get arrested, he thought. Then we might be there a while longer. He looked to see if Billy had picked up that less than encouraging thought. There was no sign that he had. What's this about? Another patient of yours. Abra Stone. She's like Billy and me, John, but I think you already know that. Only she's much, much more powerful. I've got quite a lot more than Billy, and she makes me look like a fortune teller at a county fair. Oh, my God. The spoons. It took Dan a second, then he remembered. She hung them on the ceiling. John stared at him wide-eyed. You read that in my mind? A little more mundane than that, I'm afraid. She told me. When? When? We'll get there, but not yet. First, let's try for some authentic mind reading. Dan took John's hand. That helped. Contact almost always did. Her parents came to see you when she was just a toddler. Or maybe it was an aunt or her great-gram. They were concerned about her, even before she decorated the kitchen with silverware, because there was all sorts of psychic phenomena going on in that house. And there was something about the piano. Billy, help me out here. Billy grabbed John's free hand. Dan took Billy's, making a connected circle. A teeny seance in Teeny Town.
Beatles music, Billy said. On a piano, instead of the guitar. It was... I don't know. It made him crazy for a while.
John stared at him. Listen, Dan said. You have her permission to talk. She wants you to. Trust me on this, John. John Dalton considered for almost a full minute. Then he told them everything, with one exception. That stuff about the Simpsons being on all the TV channels was just too weird. 4. When he was finished, John asked the obvious question, how did Dan know Abra Stone? From his back pocket, Dan produced a small battered notebook. On the cover was a photo of waves crashing against a headland, and the motto, No Great Thing Is Created Suddenly.
You used to carry this, didn't you? John asked.
Yes. You know Casey Kay's my sponsor, right?
John rolled his eyes. Who could forget when every time you open your mouth in a meeting you start with my sponsor Casey Kay always says.
John, nobody loves a smartass.
My wife does, he said. Because I'm a studly smartass.
Dan sighed. Look in the book.
John paged through it. These are the meetings from 2001.
Casey told me I had to do 90 and 90 and keep track. Look at the 8th one. John found it. Fraser Methodist Church. A meeting he didn't often go to, but one he knew. Printed below the notation in elaborate capital letters was the word Abra.
John looked up at Dan, not quite unbelievingly.
She got in touch with you when she was 2 months old?
You see my next meeting just below it, Dan said, so I couldn't have added her name later just to impress you.
Unless I faked the whole book, that is, and there are plenty of people in the program who'll remember seeing me with it.
Including me, John said.
Yeah, including you. In those days, I always had my meeting book in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. They were my security blankets. I didn't know who she was then, and I didn't much care. It was just one of those random touchings, the way a baby in a crib might reach out and brush your nose.
Then 2 or 3 years later, she wrote a word on a scheduling blackboard I keep in my room. The word was, hello. She kept in contact after that, every once in a while, kind of touching base. I'm not even sure she was aware she was doing it, but I was there. When she needed help, I was the one she knew and the one she reached out to.
What kind of help does she need? What kind of trouble is she in? John turned to Billy. Do you know?
Billy shook his head. I never heard of her, and I hardly ever go to Aniston.
Who said Abra lives in Aniston?
Billy cocked a thumb at Dan. He did.
Didn't he?
John turned back to Dan.
All right. Say I'm convinced. Let's have the whole thing.
Dan told them about Abra's nightmare of the baseball boy. The shapes holding flashlights on him. The woman with the knife, the one who had licked the boy's blood off her palms. About how, much later, Abra had come across the boy's picture in the shopper. And she could do this why? Because the kid they killed was another one of these shiners. I'm pretty sure that's how the initial contact happened. He must have reached out while these people were torturing him. Abra has no doubt that's what they did, and that created a link.
One that continued even after the boy, this Brad Trevor, was dead?
I think her later point of contact may have been something the Trevor kid owned, his baseball glove. And she was able to link to his killers because one of them put it on. She doesn't know how she does it, and neither do I. All I know for sure is that she's immensely powerful.
The way you are.
Here's the thing, Dan said. These people, if they are people, are led by the woman who did the actual killing. On the day Abra came across the picture of Brad Trevor on a missing children page in the local rag, she got in this woman's head. And the woman got in Abra's. For a few seconds, they looked through each other's eyes. He held up his hands, made fists, and rotated them. Turn and turn about. Abra thinks they may come for her, and so do I. Because she could be a danger to them.
There's more to it than that, isn't there? Billy asked.
Dan looked at him, waiting.
People who can do this shining thing have something, right? Something these people want. Something they can only get by killing.
Yes, John said. Does this woman know where Abra is? Abra doesn't think so, but you have to remember she's only 13. She could be wrong.
Does Abra know where the woman is?
All she knows is that when this contact, this mutual seeing occurred, the woman was in a Sam's supermarket. That puts it somewhere out west, but there are Sam's in at least 9 states,
including Iowa.
Dan shook his head.
Then I don't see what we can accomplish by going there.
We can get the glove, Dan said. Abra thinks if she has the glove, she can link to the man who had it on his hand for a little while. She calls him Barry the Chunk. John sat with his head lowered, thinking. Dan let him do it.
All right, John said at last. This is crazy, but I'll buy it. Given what I know of Abra's history and given my own history with you, it's actually kind of hard not to. But if this woman doesn't know where Abra is, might it not be wiser to leave things alone? Don't kick a sleeping dog and all that?
I don't think this dog's asleep, Dan said. These
empty devils.
Freaks want her for the same reason they wanted the Trevor boy. I'm sure Billy's right about that. Also, they know she's a danger to them. To put it in AA terms, she has the power to break their anonymity. And they may have resources we can only guess at. Would you want a patient of yours to live in fear month after month and maybe year after year? Always expecting some sort of paranormal Manson family to show up and snatch her off the street?
Of course not. These assholes live on children like her. Children like I was. Kids with the shining. He stared grimly into John Dalton's face. If it's true, they need to be stopped.
Billy said, if I'm not going to Iowa, what am I supposed to do?
Let's put it this way, Dan said. You're going to get very familiar with Aniston in the week ahead. In fact, if Casey will give you time off,
You're going to stay at a motel there.
5. Rose finally entered the meditative state she had been seeking. The hardest thing to let go of had been her worries about Grandpa Flick, but she finally got past them, got above them. Now she cruised within herself, repeating the old phrases, Sabasahante and Lord Samhante and Kahana. Risone, hante, over and over again, her lips barely moving. It was too early to seek the troublesome girl, but now that she'd been left alone and the world was quiet both inside and out, she was in no hurry. Meditation for its own sake was a fine thing. Rose went about gathering her tools and focusing her concentration, working slowly and meticulously. Sabathahanti, Lord Samhanti, Kahana, Risone, Hanti. Words that had been old when the True Knot moved across Europe in wagons, selling peat turves and trinkets. They had probably been old when Babylon was young. The girl was powerful, but the True was all powerful, and Rose anticipated no real problem. The girl would be asleep, and Rose would move with quiet stealth, picking up information and planting suggestions like small explosives. Not just one worm, but a whole nest of them. Some the girl might detect and disable, others not.
6. Abra spoke with her mother on the phone for almost 45 minutes that night after she'd finished her homework. The conversation had two levels. On the top one, they talked about Abra's day, the school week ahead, and her costume for the upcoming Halloween dance. They discussed the ongoing plans to have Momo move north to the Fraser Hospice, which Abra still thought of as the hot spice. Lucy brought Abra up to date on Momo's condition, which she said was actually pretty good, all things considered. On another level, Abra listened to Lucy's nagging worry that she had somehow failed her grandmother, and to the truth of Momo's condition, frightened, addled, racked with pain. Abra tried to send her mother soothing thoughts.
"It's all right, Mom," and "We love you, Mom," and "You did the best you could for as long as you were able."
She liked to believe that some of these thoughts got through, but didn't really believe it. She had many talents, the kind that were wonderful and scary at the same time, but changing another person's emotional temperature had never been one of them.
Could Dan do that? She thought maybe he could. She thought he used that part of his shining to help people in the hot spice. If he could really do that, maybe he would help Momo when she got there. That would be good.
She came downstairs wearing the pink flannel pajamas Momo had given her last Christmas. Her father was watching the Red Sox and drinking a glass of beer. She put a big smackaroo on his nose. He always said he hated that, but she knew he sort of liked it, and told him she was off to bed.
La homework est complète, mademoiselle?
Yes, Daddy. But the French word for homework is devoir.
Good to know, good to know.
How was your mother?
I asked because I only had about 90 seconds with her before you snatched the phone.
She's doing okay. Abra knew this was the truth, but she also knew okay was a relative term. She started for the hall, then turned back. She said Momo was like a glass ornament. She hadn't, not out loud, but she'd been thinking it. She says we all are. Dave muted the TV.
Well, I guess that's true. But some of us are made of surprisingly tough glass. Remember, your Momo's been up on the shelf safe and sound for many, many years. Now come over here, Abadou, and give your dad a hug. I don't know if you need it, but I could use one.
7. 20 minutes later, she was in bed with Mr. Pooh Bear Nightlight, a holdover from earliest childhood, glowing on the dresser. She reached for Dan
and found him in an activities room where there were jigsaw puzzles, magazines, a ping-pong table, and a big TV on the wall. He was playing cards with a couple of Hot Spice residents.
Did you talk to Dr. John?
Yes, we're going to Iowa day after tomorrow.
This thought was accompanied by a brief picture of an old biplane. Inside were two men wearing old-fashioned flying helmets, scarves, and goggles. It made Abra smile.
If we bring you...
Picture of a catcher's mitt. That wasn't what the baseball boy's glove really looked like, but Abra knew what Dan was trying to say.
Will you freak out?
No.
She better not. Holding the dead boy's glove would be terrible. But she would have to do it. 8. In the common room of Rivington 1, Mr. Braddock was staring at Dan with that look of monumental but slightly puzzled irritation which only the very old and borderline senile can bring off successfully.
Are you going to discard something, Danny, or just sit there staring into the corner until the ice caps melt?
Good night, Abra.
Good night, Dan. Say good night to Tony for me.
Danny?
Mr. Braddock knocked his swollen knuckles on the table.
Danny Torrance, come in. Danny Torrance, over.
Don't forget to set your alarm.
Hoo-hoo, Danny,
Cora Willingham said. Dan looked at them. Did I discard, or is it still my turn? Mr. Braddock rolled his eyes at Cora. Cora rolled hers right back.
And my daughters think I'm the one losing my marbles, she said.
9. Abra had set the alarm on her iPad because tomorrow was not only a school day, but one of her days to make breakfast. Scrambled eggs with mushrooms, peppers, and jack cheese was the plan. But that wasn't the alarm Dan had been talking about. She closed her eyes and concentrated, her brow furrowing. One hand crept out from under the covers and began wiping at her lips. What she was doing was tricky, but maybe it would be worth it. Alarms were all well and good, but if the woman in the hat came looking for her, a trap might be even better. After 5 minutes or so, the lines on her forehead smoothed out, and her hand fell away from her mouth. She rolled over on her side and pulled the duvet up to her chin. She was visualizing herself riding a white stallion in full warrior garb when she fell asleep. Mr. Pooh Bear Nightlight watched from his place on the dresser, as he had since Abra was 4, casting a dim radiance on her left cheek. That and her hair were the only parts of her that still showed. In her dreams, she galloped over long fields under 4 billion stars.
10. Rose continued her meditations until 1:30 that Monday morning. The rest of the crew, with the exception of Apron Annie and Big Mo, currently watching over Grandpa Flick, were sleeping deeply when she decided she was ready. In one hand she held a picture, printed off her computer, of Anniston, New Hampshire's not very impressive downtown. In the other, she held one of the canisters. Although there was nothing left inside but the faintest whiff of steam, she had no doubt it would be enough. She put her fingers on the valve, preparing to loosen it. We are the true knot, and we endure. Sabatha Hanti. We are the chosen ones. Lodsome Hanti. We are the fortunate ones. Kahana Risone Hanti. Take this and use it well, Rosie girl, she said. When she turned the valve, a short sigh of silver mist escaped. She inhaled, fell back on her pillow, and let the canister drop to the carpet with a soft thud. She lifted the picture of Aniston's main street in front of her eyes. Her arm and hand were no longer precisely there, and so the picture seemed to float. Not far from that main street, a little girl lived down a lane that was probably called Richland Court. She would be fast asleep, but somewhere in her mind was Rose the Hat.
She assumed the little girl didn't know what Rose the Hat looked like, any more than Rose knew what the girl looked like, at least not yet. But she knew what Rose the Hat felt like. Also, she knew what Rose had been looking at in Sam's yesterday.